The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky. This week, we have a special end-of-year edition of the show dedicated to a tech and digital roundup for 2013. We'll be looking at many of the triumphs and a few of the tragedies in the tech space that happened over the last 12 months. I am joined by an A-list Guardian panel, head of technology Jemima Kish, technology editor Charles Arthur, and Guardian tech reporters Samuel Gibbs and Alex Hearn. And from beyond these walls, we have a leading light in London and the UK tech scene, Jemima Garthwaite, also known as Jem. Jem is founder and director of This Here, a data-led creative startup. Welcome to you all.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Wow, that's a lot of people, isn't it?
Listen to that cacophony. I know it's going to be a heck of a ride. So hold on to your hats. You, dear listener, are welcome to a very special Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It was the year that was, and then the year that wasn't. In 2013, the privacy wars finally broke out between the people tracking us and the services that we used to hide who and where we were. We also saw the rise and the fall of giants in the industry. I mean, honestly, where do we start, Jemima Kish, with the biggest story of the year?
I don't know. I feel like we should have some bells in here or something to sort of gee us up, you know, that kind of Christmas sound. I don't know. Pick your favourite part of the NSA story because it's so massive. It stretches from the Balkan web to our own sort of privacy online to our relationship with our government through to this sort of fascinating character who's holed up somewhere in Russia or possibly soon to be Brazil. Where do we start?
Well, let's start actually with what the story was, where it began. So we first heard of Edward Snowden when?
Oh, that's a very good question.
June. It was June.
It was the 21st of June we published the first story because that was the day I got married, weirdly. completely uncoincidental, I think. So he released a huge tranche of information several months before then and worked with Glenn Greenwald, who's a freelance journalist then for The Guardian, and Laura Poitras, who's a filmmaker based in Berlin, and fastidiously combed through this information, picking out stories. There are about 58,000 files. We've published a few hundred stories of that, so we've been very selective and, we think, extremely responsible with the information that we've heavily vetted and released with a lot of it.
And give me a quick overview, Jemima, of what was contained in those files. Why has this become the tech story of the year?
Got everything from surveillance of our phone records, surveillance of everything we do online, from email and the video chat services that we use to stuff that we keep in the cloud. They haven't been able to crack stuff that is the other side of Tor, to the best of our knowledge. But if you're outside the US, then constitutionally they say that they are able to monitor what you're doing because you're a foreign citizen, which isn't enormously comforting for those of us that aren't US citizens.
We'll talk a little bit about Tor in just a second, but before we move on, Jemima, I'm curious, what do you feel that the lessons that we have learned as citizens of the world, as digital citizens, what are those lessons that we've learned?
Well, I'm bound to say that we have to trust our press. We have to trust that they're responsible and that they have our best interests at heart beyond commerce and beyond a very heavy-handed government regulation. I think we, as citizens, have to understand that we have a personal responsibility to understand the technologies that we use and the implications of it.
Charles, what do we face, do you think, in the future?
I think that you'll have a lot less trust placed in services. People won't put their trust into services quite so easily. And there'll be a lot of questions about the whether software that's not made open or doesn't have some sort of oversight, whether it has backdoors in it. So, for example, TrueCrypt, which is an encryption system which creates a virtual disk, an encrypted disk on your hard drive, is being audited to see whether there might be some way in which the NSA has snuck a backdoor in there. And I think that'll be the shape of it, really. So cloud services, software, all those sorts of things. And I think that actually people won't necessarily trust governments of any stripe not to be trying to hack into stuff.
Well, I think governments won't really be trusting each other either. I think a key moment of this story was when Angela Merkel was found to have been hacked. And she grew up in East Germany with the Stasi and was not impressed. I don't think you should underestimate how much that impacted her relationship with Obama. And there are similar ripples throughout, you know, many elements of this story.
Along similar lines, I think, and you found importance on where the company you're working with is actually based. We've seen a growing number of European companies putting based in the EU as a real selling point when they ask to look after your data.
Well, we'll go back to questions of how we are encrypting our data in just a moment. But coincidentally, also trending this year was online transience, services that made the permanent web ephemeral and impermanent. Now, Jemima Kish, the biggest service of them all, although we heard from Charles about another service, was Snapchat. What is Snapchat? Who are they? And what other kinds of things are out there that are part of this kind of transience?
Well, you can take a video or you can take a photo and then you can set it to self-destruct after, say, 5 or 10 seconds, whatever, however many seconds you prefer, so that the person you're sending it to can only see it briefly. And it was sort of a bit maligned to start with as just a sexting app. But I think it taps into something a bit more interesting, which is actually it makes the web, it makes this huge burden of content a bit more manageable, a bit more human, if it's allowed to disperse, if it's allowed to, I don't know, evaporate in a way. It goes back to this, do you remember the book about the right to forget we were talking about recently, Alex? So it's actually quite helpful that information would just have a limited sort of lifespan. There are other services looking at this, but they have more of a security focus. So Wicca is one of them, and Griffin too. I think advertisers will arguably like them because there's a powerful emotional sentiment about the compulsion to do something in the now. So it's definitely a trend that's going to persist, I think.
Now, Jem, you've spoken about this type of transience, this idea of services that only capture the moment, as Jemima is saying. But you also think that there are other aspects of this that perhaps are larger on a kind of societal level, don't you? That, you know, this is the idea of moving from physical to a digital space. Tell me a little bit more about this.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Snapchat, there are 350 million Snapchats shared a day, and the very next day, almost none of them will exist, which is a kind of beautiful thing. And it's the far extreme end from letter writing through to sending a piece of communication that completely disappears the next day. And actually, if you cross this over, you know, people are getting used to this notion of not owning something and not existing actually physically in your hands. We used to have LPs and now we have Spotify and YouTube. We used to buy DVDs and we now have Netflix subscriptions. And really, it's just that used to be a really geeky thing. The idea of downloading a movie, you used to be slightly breaking a law, or you were definitely one of the geekier people in your friendship circle. But now it's become so commonplace. It's an absolutely everyday thing. And so it's really crossing over into people's everyday life. I think if you take it to the extreme, the youth of today can't, for example, afford to maybe buy a property in the future because properties are so expensive. But ownership is seen as such an important part of our identity as a human being. I own a house. I own a shelf of LPs and they're beautiful physical things. I own physical books. But actually, I think that's shifting. And so, you know, renting is becoming much more commonplace.
Now, the opportunity to hide online became even more attainable this year, if we're talking about attainability, as Tor, which was formerly known as the Onion Router, in fact, it may still be, but I don't think it is, went mainstream. Alex, tell me a little bit about what Tor is and why it got a boost this year.
So Tor is at heart a rather canny piece of technology which lets you browse the internet completely anonymously. It's called the Onion Router because it's a very good metaphor for understanding how it works. Essentially, you build a network of servers like layers of an onion, and you enter the onion at one side, bounce around between these layers, and come out at the other side. And what that means is that no one observing your traffic coming out the other end can work out where you are. It got its boost? Well, It's not the best publicity for the programme, but it got its boost essentially due to its involvement with sites like the Silk Road, Sheep Marketplace and Black Market Reloaded. These are internet sites which exist exclusively on Tor and let people use an anonymous currency called Bitcoin to buy mostly drugs very illegally. Royal Mail, of course, is just as implicated as Tor because people post things through the through the mail, but for some reason they haven't got the bad publicity.
But just one thing, though. I mean, when we say that it exists on Tor, there isn't a separate network that Tor is. I mean, you know, all these servers actually have physical locations and they are connected. It's just that their actual location is anonymized. You can't drill down towards a specific IP address.
So, Charles, is that the darknet?
Not exactly, no. The darknet is a different, Tor embodies the darknet, but the darknet is a superset of which Tor is part.
Well, interestingly, within academic circles, people have been talking about the darknet for a while, but they talk about it as in that people can't access the stuff, and mostly it's not illegal, it's academic articles. So, you know, decide what you will about the quality of academic articles. But it's now this year seems to have become associated with nefarious and illegal activity.
That's quite a loose term, and it's sort of come to mean darker things on the web, as in bad stuff. But actually, technically, the closest you could come is things that aren't indexed by Google. So obviously that would be things that are accessed and hosted through Tor, as well as, you know, I don't know, whatever other bad stuff you want to scoop up in that.
To be honest, the first time I heard the phrase, the word darknet was in 1993 or 4.
I don't think Alex was even born then.
I was born then. I wasn't out of primary school.
And it was it was a guy who was writing a sort of semi manifesto about, you know, we can use the anonymity of the net to get all sorts of nefarious things done if we want. And he sort of wrote it sort of partly as a joke, but also partly to say, hey, this internet thing, you know, it's quite cool and anonymous. And he was enormously amused. I was actually there when it sort of came pinging. A journalist came in to a conference where he was and said, hey, I've just found this thing on the internet about a darknet. You know, what do you know about the darknet? He said, I wrote that. He was, you know, enormously pleased. But, yeah, the idea has been pinging around for absolutely years. And I think it's only, you know, recently that things like Tor and Bitcoin have come along, which have in effect enabled that to become reality. So that, you know, with Silk Road, you see a manifestation of something where you can get to it, but you don't know quite where you are. So what was something that you know was really only theoretical for a long time, now you're paying with an almost untraceable electronic currency. Now you're, you know, asking people to carry out a hit on someone and you're paying with this anonymous untraceable currency. So yeah, you know, the sort of darknet ideas, and those are sort of literally the things he was talking about. Unfortunately, I can't remember his name at the moment, which is sort of appropriate.
See the comment stream later, I think, yeah.
But speaking of transience, what's more impermanent than the question, what are you doing right now? No, right now. Twitter, the social network that made right now a profitable enterprise, floated into a much more permanent place in the world on NASDAQ. Charles, tell us a bit about the run-up to the float.
So Twitter, which had been widely expected to float this year, though a lot of people thought it would come rather earlier in the year, announced that it was going to file an S-1, which is the way of saying, OK, we are going to actually float some shares now on the market, through a tweet. Then in November, it did actually float, and it has about 240 million users out of 2.4 billion people online. So that's about 10% of the world's online population, which isn't bad. Although Facebook is doing rather better with about half the online population, 1.2 billion. And it floated in November, valued at about $10.9 billion when it floated. The price since then has risen from around about $20 to what it presently is of $56. So it's valued now at about $30 billion. Nothing to be sneezed at. It's nothing, you know, to compare in terms of valuation with the Googles or the Facebooks of this world, but it's pretty substantial for a company which just exists on sending 140-character tweets around the world and the occasional bit of promoted advertising in it.
Jem, you have a theory that, you know, once Twitter became a kind of part of the dominant paradigm, it's shifting things in terms of how we do marketing and who we think of as an underdog.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the interesting thing about Twitter is Twitter floating is that it does feel like it signals the end of the underdog in the terms of social media networks that are rising from nowhere to prominence. So we've got Google, who own YouTube. We've got Twitter, who own Vine. We have Facebook, that own Instagram. And actually, if you go a little bit further, we've got we've got LinkedIn, that own SlideShare. So either the networks, the big networks, are buying the smaller niche networks. And actually, you know, or they're ignoring those smaller networks and actually trying to integrate the technology into their own networks. So Snapchat was supposedly offered $3 billion by Facebook, reportedly as well $4 billion by Google, and turned it down. Surprise, surprise, since then, Instagram and Twitter have both just released the ability to send photo messages to each other. So you can see that someone like Snapchat either needs to take that offer or face, you know, potential demise. But I think from where I sit, if I look at Twitter, as you said before, it is the social network that made right now a profitable enterprise. And from a marketer's perspective, it's really the end of batch processing and a move to real time. So we used to sit with a marketing calendar for a whole year, you know, marketing strategy, you know, key products that we wanted to communicate, which channels were we going to use, how are we going to communicate those? You know, let's make some videos, let's make some content. And actually, what's shifted is that instead of targeting audiences with your products, we're trying to target people that have an interest with stories that are going to interest them. So you know, brands are becoming much more like publishers, and that's definitely not a new story. What's really taken off this year is newsjacking and real-time marketing. And actually, it's kind of backfired for some brands because you had the first brand to really stand out was Oreos, who newsjacked or took advantage of the electricity cutout of the Super Bowl with a tweet that, you know, saw tens of thousands of retweets. And then that was decided that that's the way to do it. That's the way we're going to market. And tons of brands have tried to do it. And if you look at the royal wedding, and we can see so many brands producing really below par kind of average you know, tweets and content trying to newsjack. And even AT&T in the States on 9/11 produced a photograph of a phone, a nondescript smartphone, looking at where the Twin Towers used to stand with a beautiful picture of the Twin Towers on the phone. And the caption read, "Never forget." Now, that saw thousands of retweets before it was swiftly removed. So it's indicative of a massive trend, but it's also, you know, brands need to really savvy up if they're going to do real-time marketing and newsjack in the quality that someone like The Guardian or BBC does.
And also thinking about how people do marketing on other social networks, like, for example, Facebook. Jemima Kish, throwing briefly forward to the future, what do you think happens to Facebook service in light of all of these transiencies?
Well, I realise there are still a couple of people using Facebook, but it just seems sort of completely irrelevant when I go on. It's not tailored enough to me. It claims to be a representation of my friends and my networks, and it isn't really. It's extremely selective. It's just a time sink. It's not that useful. It doesn't actually serve a function beyond a sort of gossipy voyeurism. I know this is what people were saying about Facebook right at the beginning, and I was sort of, no, it's really interesting. We should keep an eye on this. And in a way, I sort of still recognise that. But this idea of just being efficient with our time and with our tools is really important. And also the idea that they're, you know, doing all this stuff with our data, it's in a whole new light now because of the NSA story. So, I don't know, maybe there's something to be reconstructed around Facebook that is a more ephemeral, more relevant, more, I don't know, more human way of interacting with people that just isn't such a bloody waste of time.
Well, responding to what Jem was saying, today Facebook announced automatic play of video ads in people's timelines. So it seems that they are adapting to this notion of ephemerality.
The trouble with Facebook is that they try and organise your newsfeed for you. The joy of Twitter is that it's just the most recent tweet is the tweet that you see at the top of your newsfeed. Mm. And that's very, very pleasing. And more when you go over to Facebook, all I see now is either BuzzFeed articles or because I work in marketing and I hear about memes and viral videos, you know, more or less within hours or minutes that they go viral. I then unfortunately have to spend weeks waiting for other people in my friendship network to then share them and get really excited about them. And it's just more and more, I completely agree with you, Jemima, it's just become repeats, basically. It's like watching Corrie repeats.
The thing that attracted me to Twitter to start with was that it was 140 characters, and it was that brevity that really worked, and that's still what works, you know, 7 years on.
I've always thought Facebook has the exact opposite problem of most Silicon Valley companies. Most, you know, if you're not making a particular popular product, you've got to fight to get your own company using it, so you end up building something fantastic. This is why Eric Schmidt not using an Android phone was so embarrassing for Google. Facebook's got the opposite problem, which is that all of its engineers use Facebook exclusively. And I'm sure if you are on Facebook for everything and everyone you know only uses Facebook, it's fantastic. All of those life events, the idea that you might like your doctor and then find other doctors nearby, they're brilliant. No one in the real world actually uses it that way. And so no one in Facebook gets to see what Facebook is like for 90% of its users. Just a load of BuzzFeed articles, memes, and pictures of that person you haven't seen since you left school.
We emerge now from the darkness and despair to talk about the leading lights of the tech scene in 2013. But this year wasn't bright and shiny for all the stalwarts of the digital age. Something that we thought would be permanent was 2005's technology of the year, BlackBerry. But now, Charles, it's not looking so good, is it? What's happened to BlackBerry?
The trouble with BlackBerry, well, the trouble that BlackBerry has is that what it used to have as a USP, its unique selling proposition, which was, hey, you know, you can get your email on your phone and you can make phone calls with it as well, has basically been eroded by iPhone and Android, particularly iPhone in the enterprise, which has meant that people have been using iPhones instead or buying iPhones. So when you actually look at the trends, the number of BlackBerries in use by consumers, this isn't sort of enterprises, peaked in the US in about October of 2010. And since then, it has been dropping just like a stone. And it announces its financial results on Friday. They're really not expected to be good, although I can't sort of find any forecasts on how many handsets they might have shifted. But the expectation is that it's simply going nowhere. And all the sales figures, the estimates I've seen from companies like Kantar, Context suggests that in some places its sales fell below being able to measure it, below a tenth of a percent. So it just shows up as zero in China, in Japan, and in a number of other countries.
Sam, tell me a bit about the BBZ10 and the Q10.
So basically, this was BlackBerry's attempt to try and reinvent its phones. And one of the issues that BlackBerry faces from the consumer side is that it's basically stood still for years. Its platform hasn't evolved very far, and it basically offering the same email solution as Charles said. And so the Z10 was the first all touchscreen BlackBerry, and that was released sometime this year. And let's just say that it was a confusing experience for the average user. It was a gesture-based interface, which was quite different from the kind of key-based interface that BlackBerry users were used to, but it wasn't particularly intuitive. So trying to find your way around the phone was a struggle, even for an experienced tech journalist. Trying to find, for instance, notifications was unusually hard, and that really hit home when the user picked that up and just didn't know what the hell they were doing. It just didn't sell well. Maybe it's just a Canadian thing. Perhaps the Canadians have that kind of swipey gesture in their nature. I don't know. I mean,
you mustn't say that just as The Guardian is about to launch in Canada.
I mean, I have many good friends that are Canadians, and they're very smart people. But perhaps in the same way that Facebook engineers only live on Facebook, BlackBerry people only lived on BlackBerry and didn't see what was going on in the outside world, didn't appreciate what they needed to be like. So the Q10 was kind of a halfway house. It was their BlackBerry 10 OS, but on a more traditional touchscreen with keyboard layout. So you had the unfaltering BlackBerry keyboard below, but everything else was done through swiping and tapping gestures. And again, that was kind of released a bit too late. They went with the Z10, which kind of put people off. And by the time they'd released the Q10, which might have appealed to hardcore BlackBerry users, they'd already switched or been kind of tempted by the other side.
There are all sorts of incompatibility problems as well, because if you had a BB10 handset, then you couldn't use it with your old your BES7, BlackBerry Enterprise Server 7 software, so you'd have to upgrade that. But if you got the new BES 10 server, then you had compatibility problems with your old BB7 handset, so you had to sort of do it all at once or not at all. And the little trials that people tried, where they tried the Z10 handset, they said, we really don't like these compared to our, you know, keyboard-based old BB7s. So actually, I suspect that there's going to be a real crisis for BlackBerry. They've got a new chief executive now, John Chen, who formerly ran Sybase. They've kicked out Torsten Hines, who was the guy who took over from the two founders back in January of 2012. I suspect BlackBerry is going to stop making the Z10 handset sometime in the next 12 months. I think that actually the focus is going to be on how do they keep their existing customers, all the ones who are on the BB7 handsets, how do they keep them happy? That's actually crucial for them in terms of getting revenues in the future, because really they're going to have to focus not on the handsets generating revenue, because it's questionable whether those ever generated much in the way of profits outright. They're going to have to focus on the services, and the way they're going to keep those services going is by keeping people with the BB7 handsets. So I think they're going to have to find contractors who will make BB7 handsets, keep all the existing sort of 50 million or so enterprise users happy. It might be fewer than that. Might be actually sort of 30 to 35 million if it's half of their user base in enterprise. They'll have to focus on keeping them happy, keeping them on board. And you know, to some extent, BB10 will just be a little accident of history.
Other Goliaths of the tech industry had their own epoch shifts. Steve Ballmer stood down for Microsoft. Charles, when? Why?
Well, he's going to be going sometime in 2014, and he'll be replaced by a new chief executive who might be from inside Microsoft, might be from outside. He stood down because the board, in effect, pushed him out, which in turn was coming because there was pressure from activist investors who felt that the Microsoft share price wasn't moving fast enough, and the reason it wasn't increasing fast enough was because Microsoft's efforts in the whole mobile space, particularly with smartphones and tablets, really haven't had very much impact. So whereas Microsoft has 95% or so of the desktop market, it has about 5%, if you're generous, of the mobile market if you put tablets and smartphones together. So the problem for Ballmer was he couldn't shift the needle there, and nothing that he seemed to be able to do would shift it. Even though he announced a reorganization in mid-year, around sort of July time, which will turn Microsoft into a, quote, devices and services business. And quite how they make that payoff is an interesting question, because it's one of, do you make the devices the profit centers, or is it the services of the profit centers? And how do you, how do you choose which one? He's got a real, a real problem, and he just didn't really feel like doing it anymore. He just felt he had given it his best shot, and the pressure from the board in the end, I think, just wore him down.
Oh, but maybe his emotional outpouring, as he basically said bye one of the last internal Microsoft press event, well, not press events, group events. He was a very, very teary Steve Ballmer. It was almost heartbreaking.
Is Bill Gates to follow, Charles?
I think it's quite likely, given that he can't really be there as chairman, which is his position at the moment, executive chairman. He can't really do that without it seeming like he's looking over the shoulder of whoever the new chief executive is. And the problem then becomes one of, well, I wouldn't do it that way. But the thing is, Microsoft has to change. The whole environment in which it operates now is so different. The whole need for search, the need for services, the need for mobile means that it's just not the same place as when Bill Gates ruled the roost in 1995, and it was all about Windows 3.1, Windows XP, the road ahead, all that sort of stuff. It just doesn't look like it did back then. And even though Bill Gates is great at seeing technology trends and seeing them a long way off, he's not that good at letting other people do them. He really wants to be hands-on. And he's got a fantastic charity now, which is doing good works around the world. And actually, he could have just as much impact on the world doing that.
Now, you mentioned that the ecosystem is different now. Is this why Microsoft internally and technologically reshuffled? So, for example, Windows 8 was thrown into a giant rejig.
Well, as I say, they're trying to recreate the company now as a devices and services business. Then they're organizing it so that marketing, for example, works across all the divisions of Microsoft. In effect, they're trying to make themselves to be organized rather like Apple, because Apple has the same sort of thing, where you have a central design department, you have a sort of software people who work on software projects all over the place. But no one in those departments thinks, well, we've got to make a profit on this or else we're out. The trouble with Microsoft always used to be that if you were working in search and you wanted to have something in Windows, you had to go and make the financial case of the people in Windows, because otherwise they'd just kick you out and say, well, no, that's not going to make me money. Why should I bother? And this was the bugbear of Microsoft's organization for absolutely years, was that in effect all the divisions were at war with each other.
But Microsoft bought Nokia, Charles. So tell me a bit about that deal.
So the problem that Nokia had was that it had thrown it all in to go with Windows Phone. And although Nokia is fantastic at making phones, people in effect rejected Windows Phone in the market, or at least had done so far. Part of the problem there was that Windows Phone was 3 years late coming to the mobile space, launching in October 2010 compared to the iPhone in June of 2007 on Android in sort of 2008-09. And that meant that they were behind in apps. Android was already building an app store before it actually had a phone. And it meant that they were behind in terms of what people expected to see. So Nokia has been losing money hand over fist in the smartphone space for years now. And Microsoft needs to have mobile as one of its planks, because that's where it has to go. And If you can imagine Microsoft with huge pots of money and a need to be mobile, and you imagine Nokia, which is a Finnish company, which is losing money and didn't want to be losing money, the logic of it led them to decide that they should sell off the handset division to Microsoft, which can then fund it pretty much into eternity, while Nokia focuses on its network business and also keeps on the search business and a pretty handy patent portfolio.
It was particularly apparent with the Xbox, the one thing that was actually making money for Microsoft, and it was basically there was an ironclad wall between the Xbox division and basically everything else. It's less so much now, and especially with things like Xbox Smart Glass and the move towards integrated products. But that's the way they've got to go. And one of the reasons they're playing so much into search is because it's one of the unifying factors across most of Microsoft's products.
Jemima Kish, British designer Johnny Ive emerged as an invisible force inside of Apple. He'd been there all along, but why did he really come to the fore this year in 2013?
Oh, well, he got to fiddle with the software this year, and this was the part of Apple where skeuomorphism was everywhere. So the fake wood of the bookcases and the fake paper of notes. And once Johnny Ive got his hands on that, there was a whole new look and feel, which some people said was a bit more like Android, but has definitely given Apple's devices an update that it really needed. There was a really good biography of Johnny Ive out this year. As we know, very little information comes out of Apple about anything. So there were some delicious nuggets in here about the design process and the team structure inside Apple. The fact that they have 16 designers, Samsung has thousands. The fact that they have these two-hour-long brainstorming meetings around these huge wooden benches, very like the ones in Apple stores. And they very religiously store all of their notes and ideas and sketches in these hard-bound sketchbooks. A design department is completely central to what Apple does. There were insights in this biography into the working relationship between Johnny Ive and Steve Jobs. And it was absolutely fascinating that on at least two occasions, other executives came to Steve and said, it's him or me, and Steve chose Johnny every time.
It's Leander Carney's biography of Johnny Ive. The word magical appeared too many times for my liking, to be honest.
Well, there was a lot of padding in there, it has to
be
said.
But at the same time, there was one point where it said that he chose a casing for the Mac Mini. They sized the Mac Mini without any reference to the size of the hard drives that would have to go into it. And he chose a size which was 2 millimetres too small to accommodate a hard drive, which would have been substantially cheaper. And I looked at that and I thought, I'm not sure whether that's entirely right way to be designing products. If 2 millimeters can't be allowed, a difference that most people would not be able to perceive, and yet you say, no, I'm sorry, we're not going to have this hard drive in because I've chosen something that's 2 millimeters smaller. That's pretty remarkable.
Well, the book was actually quite good at flagging up a lot of his failures as well, which is really fascinating. It wasn't all puff. And also a car crash where he nearly died, which is fascinating. He's got a real kind of, you know, fast car thing, as you might expect. And when he nearly died, Apple bumped his salary up considerably because they suddenly realised how indispensable he is.
Which is scary. What happens when he retires or, you know, whatever?
Well, then they have the whole Steve Jobs is completely irreplaceable thing all over again, but with Johnny Ive.
And on the other side of the proverbial Valley of Silicon was a tech entrepreneur with a big dream. Larry Page fantasized about an island without laws where he could just test stuff. Charles, you're on top of this story, but Jemima, you have a few things to say about it too. Charles first.
So it was Larry Page talking at the end of the Google I.O. event back in May, and he sort of turned up and surprised everyone by actually doing a long Q&A, which is you know, intriguing in itself because he's not appeared in public very much because he had problems with his vocal cords before. One of the interesting things when he was asked how he could make the world a more positive place for people to build weird new things, and he said, I think people are naturally concerned about change. We're changing quickly, but some of our institutions, like some laws, aren't changing with that. Laws about technology can't be right if it's 50 years old. That's before the internet. Maybe more of us need to go into other areas to help them improve and understand technology. We don't want our world to change too fast, but maybe we could set apart a piece of the world, an environment where people can try new things. I think as technologists, we should have some safe places where we can try out new things and figure out the effect on society. What's the effect on people without having to deploy it to the whole world?
It's quite a romantic idea, I think, isn't it? Yeah, but it is. It's quite a romantic idea, isn't it? Where you've got your mad scientist castle in the sky. Jemima, is this something that's going to happen? He is richer than sin, after all.
Burning Man, basically. I think he just wants Burning Man. No, it's not going to happen unless he buys sea land or somewhere and makes it, you know, his own domain where he can make up, I don't know, whatever rules you want. But if they can't do this kind of stuff in Google, where can they do it? The thing is, it's a bit like going back to what we've already said twice, which is that if you're just constantly in your own bubble, making your own technology, you're not considering, you know, what is the user need, as developers like to say. So I don't think you should do it anyway.
2013 wasn't just about software or indeed the people behind the screens. We can't use the software if it isn't for the hardware. And this year was an innovation extravaganza. Jemima Kish, tell me about Google Glass, because as far as I know, you were one of the first people in that room who had a go on it.
I had a very short go, yes. I keep pestering them and haven't got a test kit yet. But it's quite compelling. I don't wear glasses, so I found it a bit weird to wear a pair of glasses anyway, especially ones with no lens. You just feel weird. So I don't have a problem with the technology. It's just the form factor is just a bit silly. And if you were to walk down the street in that, you would feel a bit of a wally. The problems with it are obviously that there are implications for people driving. There was a lady in California who got a ticket. It's not the problem that you might be listening to something or giving verbal commands. It's that there is a screen. I mean, it's a tiny screen and it's really minimal and it's far less distracting than a GPS, you know, than a sat-nav screen.
But then in addition, there were lots of concerns about privacy as well, because there's a forward-facing camera in the device.
There is, and there's already a lot of places in San Francisco and the Valley that have banned it. So restaurants, for example. I think the problem is that you say, OK, Google, record. And, you know, if you're a geek and you've been following the OK Google trend, you know exactly what that means. But I always think of my mum, and she'd have no idea that the strange glasses I was wearing would be recording something. And therefore, most people in the world would not realise that they were being watched. And this is the single biggest obstacle, I think, for Google bringing this more broadly to market, is that they have to recognise and acknowledge people's concerns about it and not say, oh no, it's not a problem at all, which is what they've done so far.
Jem, how much do you feel within the marketing space, wearable technologies, of which Google Glass is just one example, how much do you feel that they've had an impact in 2013? Have they just started to creep into people's consciousnesses so that we'll have a big swarm of them next year? Or is this just still something that's so completely out of the ordinary?
The The only piece of wearable technology which I see commonly worn by normal human beings is the Nike Fuel Band. And for some reason, loads of people I know have one, partly because Nike just seem to give them out quite a lot to people, because they want people to be wearing them. And people get quite excited about it. And I think that the interesting thing is I've started using Nike Plus for running. I don't know if anyone else in the room uses that.
A while ago when I used to be asked to go running, yeah.
I'm trying to get involved in that, and I've started following friends who are also on Nike Plus. And you can actually start to compare your kind of running speed with your friends. And that's only when you've got your phone on you and you've got the kind of Nike Plus gadgetry. But if you've got the Fuel Band, you can kind of compare your whole lifestyle. And then there's also the additional value that, let's say, you have an illness which requires, you know, to monitor your health or tell you when you need to take medication or let you know when your blood pressure is dropping or whatever it is, where that technology can actually really help society and improve services like the NHS. So I think Nike Fuel Band is the only piece of wearable tech that I've actually seen really take off.
There's Jawbone as well. I mean, I've on at least three occasions now, I've had people sort of casually drop, "I need to get the steps in," into conversations. You know, like really actively working on the data that they're, you know, recording about themselves every day. And it's not just about sort of performance running. It's that kind of ambient data that, you know, it's 1,000 steps between here and the tube station. And, you know, I might just get off a tube stop early to get the steps in. That's a thing now.
That is quite weird, I have to say. I mean, Paul Carr, I think, described it perfectly when he said it's vanity metrics. I mean, it really is. That, yeah, being that is slave to the machine in just the most unbelievable way.
Speaking of being slave to machines, Samuel, this year the tablet went mainstream again, and smartphones and especially something called a phablet began rising. Please, somebody tell me, what is a phablet?
So a phablet is basically a phone crossed with a tablet, and in real terms it means a device with a screen bigger than 5 inches that has cellular networking capabilities, so they can make phone calls and use mobile broadband, and generally has a touchscreen. And in real terms, the best example of a phablet is probably the Galaxy Note series, the Samsung, that basically has a large screen with a stylus.
And was this year really the year of the phablet tablet thing?
It was definitely the year of the tablet. The phablets came in force, and they are definitely a big trend, more so in Pacific Asia than, say, in the UK, generally because people don't want a phone quite that big because there's nowhere to put it. I mean, for instance, a phablet generally doesn't fit in a pocket, and if you wear skinny jeans or anything, you've got no chance whatsoever. But the tablet really, really took off this year. I mean, last year was kind of heralded as the year of the tablet. This year is definitely the year of the tablet.
I saw a guy, a very cool fashion student, I'd assume, walking through King's Cross. He had an iPad mini in his back pocket, and it stuck out a lot and only just fitted, but it was the conspicuous sort of, you know.
In King's Cross as well. I tell you, that part of town, it's changing dramatically.
Properly dodged. I mean, the biggest thing for me was that this year saw that affordable tablets in the region of £120 and down, became much more mainstream and showed that a cheap tablet didn't have to necessarily be a frustrating experience. And one of the standout features for me was the Tesco Huddle. Now, I was surprised when Tesco launched a tablet. Not the first people you kind of think of when thinking about consumer electronics, a grocer. But they basically saw that the budget tablet market was going some and decided to launch their own brand tablet, very price conscious, but with a set specification that would perform the daily duties that most people require without being astronomically expensive. And at £119, it kind of hit the mark. And of course, Tesco has their own club card points as well, and you could pick this thing up for £60 worth of club card vouchers, which is an absolute steal. And that started a trend. We saw Argos try to follow up with the My Tablet, which was truly poor, and the Audi launched their own tablet briefly and sold out within 24 hours, as we discussed before. So this was basically the year where the price of a tablet and the performance of a tablet intersected for most people in the mainstream. They're now getting down to almost a disposable item, something that you don't have to really think about too much before you purchase.
And what does this mean for the PC?
So, I mean, we're supposedly in the post-PC era, and PC sales have certainly been declining, whilst tablet sales have been expanding exponentially. And many people are, basically, especially the budget tablets, are being bought by people who would not necessarily buy a PC or a laptop, and they can do most of what somebody would need to on a PC, on a much cheaper, more portable and potentially user-friendly manner. Now, the PC industry is kind of going through a decline, at least in the consumer side of things. Business is what's holding up PCs, because you need PCs in most of business. But the iPad, for instance, is starting to see a larger and larger penetration within business. If you step into a meeting area now, you see almost more iPads than you do laptops out, because people can do most of what they need. I mean, meeting notes, that kind of thing, easily done on a touchscreen surface.
The PC might not be thrown out the window yet, but it's certainly sitting in the corner gathering dust, certainly in my parents' house. Whilst one in two UK individuals between 25 and 35 actually do own a tablet now, and that's partly because of the example that Sam was just saying about business use being so practical. It's actually the much older demographic. It's the 60 plus who used to have an aging PC in the corner. They didn't know how to turn it on, and then their kids have come up and said, look, you know, mum and dad, why don't you get a tablet? I'll buy you an iPad 2 or iPad mini. And you know, mums and dads all the world over realise that actually it's much more convenient just to have the little iPad out than it is to fire up the PC in the corner. And it's not just being used to use email. It's things like BBC iPlayer, Channel 4 On Demand. And actually it was the Olympics that really drove a huge surge in popularity of the use of iPlayer amongst that older demographic, because people suddenly realise, oh, I want to watch the women's archery under 21s, and it's not on BBC, so I'll figure out this whole iPlayer thing. And also Christmas. So every Christmas, there's a whole new wave of individuals getting onto tablets. And now, if you compare what we would call the fixed web, so people using the internet, the fixed web on their computers at their desk, versus those using the mobile web, so that's tablets, smartphones, we're now looking at circa 30% of internet usage is not the fixed web. So people building websites, designing businesses, creating products and services are no longer thinking, well, let's make it work on the internet. They're thinking, let's make it work on mobile. And that's a massive shift to mobile first.
And perhaps, Charles, that's why we're starting to see compressions of smartphone companies as they move into a critical mass, when they become the primary source of connecting with the internet, with creating documents, with editing movies, with sharing and communicating. This year, we had Apple and Samsung sort of compressing and contracting. Their infighting continued. What happened in that space?
So generally in the smartphone space, Apple and Samsung really dominate, so that they're really the two big players. And then you have loads and loads of other small ones. We've mentioned BlackBerry already. Nokia is making some inroads. It's actually been growing its smartphone figures. But really, it's only Nokia and a lot of the smaller Chinese companies, of whom many people won't have heard. Companies like Coolpad or Xiaomi and so on. Lenovo is making some inroads. Huawei, ZTE, these are all names that you're going to know in the future. Also of interest is Micromax, which is an Indian company, which has big ambitions too. They want to unseat Samsung as the biggest seller of smartphones in India. And they might actually do it, because they do have real determination. But the thing is that Samsung has the scale to build phones really cheaply, and they build a lot of different phones. And Apple has the premium end, and it hangs onto that premium end really effectively. So for companies like HTC and Motorola, which is now owned by Google, of course, and LG, all that you really see generally is either maintaining the status quo or else shrinking. And HTC certainly has a big problem. I think it'll be very intriguing to see what happens in 2014 there.
Well, it has been really interesting given how much we've spoken about lots and lots of different strands of digital technology. But what seems to keep coming back is that we're seeing a kind of convergence of the larger organizations, whether they're consuming or assuming other companies, or they're starting to put out their own services. So arguably, you know, by 2014, each of the main digital technology companies, Apple, Microsoft, and Google, will have a phone handset business, a mapping business, cloud syncing business. They'll operate on both desktops and they'll operate on phones. They'll have TV. They'll have watches. Charles, is this what the modern digital big enterprise business needs to do? Answer all the questions.
Well, I mean, it really is interesting, isn't it? That when you look at Apple and Microsoft and Google, which, you know, 5 years ago were really different. You would say, well, you know, Google is mainly sort of, it's a search engine. You know, Microsoft, yeah, they do sort of software for PCs. Apple, well, you know, they sort of do some computers and they've got a phone. And now you have this incredible similarity between all of them. You know, which is that by 2014, Microsoft will own Nokia. It'll have a mapping business through its own Bing Maps. It'll have a cloud syncing service through Azure and stuff. And it'll do Windows Phone. It'll do Windows on the desktop. Similarly for Google, it's got Chrome and it's got Android. It's got Motorola making phones for it. Apple does phones, it does mapping, it does cloud stuff, and it has iOS for tablets, and it does macOS for the desktop. So it seems like you do have to have all these things if you're really going to be a global digital business like this. And I think that the things to watch out for will be companies coming out of China, which have a spread like this. So Baidu could be really interesting. And companies which don't have those things at the moment, but which have some elements of them, such as Samsung, which very much wants to be in that sort of more profitable space where you're doing the software and services, which is where the money really can start to come in, because they know they can be profitable with mobile phones, but they want to make the money in the software and the services as well. So, you know, the thing for next year to watch out for is how well do these companies integrate these things, and where actually do they make their money? You know, do they make it out of the handsets, or do they make it out of the services, or do they make it from the software?
There was so much more that we could have covered this week, from fingerprinting security technology to 3D printing on your high street. But I'm afraid that is all the time we have for the year that was. As always, it's been a roller coaster ride. A huge thank you to my Guardian colleagues for all their work on the podcast this year: Charles Arthur, Jemima Kish, Alex Hearn, and Samuel Gibbs. Remember, you can read all their journalism over the holiday period at theguardian.com/technology. Also, a huge thanks to Jemima Garthwaite, or Jem, as we called her on this podcast. You can check out Jem's work at thishere.co.uk or follow her on Twitter at this here, and we will have links on the blog for that show. But for me, Alex Kratosky in Florence, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps in London, happy Christmas, happy New Year to one and all, and we will be back in January with our crystal balls looking ahead. Join us then. Bye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
The Guardian.